Actually, in a way, this talk follows on from the talk on renunciation, because it's going to be a talk about meditation. So you could say meditation really is the purpose of renunciation. And, you know, one practices renunciation of the world in order to create those better conditions for the practice of meditation. So the one does, in a way, lead into the other. We don't actually find in Milarepa's songs a systematic presentation of meditation teachings. I think I mentioned this the other day, didn't I, that Milarepa's teachings are not systematically presented. That systematization was done really by Gampopa afterwards, after Milarepa had died. But we can still learn an awful lot about Milarepa's experience of meditation through the songs. In a way, this is very much in accord with the tantric tradition. The tantric tradition emphasizes experience, really. It's about communicating experience in many, many different ways. So it asks the question not so much how do you do the spiritual life, but what do you experience on the spiritual life? It's trying to get at the actual experience. So, of course, this is going to be pretty unsystematic. Most people's experience of the spiritual life is unsystematic. It doesn't all follow nice, easy steps one after the other. It's rather chaotic series of experiences. But at least in looking at Milarepa's meditation experience, which is what we're going to do, we're looking at his experience rather than the methods that he practices. All the philosophies that supported his practice. Although at the end I will be saying a little bit about Mahamudra, which is in a way about practice, although it's also about not practice. So I'm going to look at three different stories which illustrate three different aspects of meditation experience and working in meditation. I'm going to look at the way that Milarepa engaged with demons. I'm going to look at the way that he communicated with devas, and I'm going to look at his practice of Mahamudra. So those will be the three parts of the talk. So we'll start off by looking at Milarepa's ways of working with demons. And the story that I'm going to use for this is the very first story in the 100,000 Songs. It's the tale of Red Rock Jewel Valley, which is quite, I think, probably quite familiar. Most people know of it. In this story, we start Milarepa's... He's sort of at the beginning of his time in the mountains. He's not been there that long. He's gone off into the mountains. He's meditating. And he's been meditating fairly well in a cave. And he comes out of his meditation one day and realizes that he's let supplies get a bit low. He hasn't got any wood. He hasn't got any water. So he feels he perhaps should collect some wood and some water. So he goes out to collect some wood, and a wind blows up. And so he's holding his robe around him, and he's sort of picking up some wood. And as he picks up the wood, the wind catches his robe. So he grabs his robe and drops the wood. And so the robe blows off and finishes up a tree. The wood is scattered all over the place. And he's just... he just thinks, this is samsara. You know, this is... What's the point? What's the point? You know, this is what existence is all about. It's just conflict and chaos and wind, and you can't get anything done properly, and everything's a disaster, and I'm fed up. And I just don't know... what I'm going to do about it. I'm really kind of fed up with all of this. It's not an uncommon experience, I think. You can come home from a retreat where you've been in these blissful, tranquil states, and you get home and there's, you know, this little mini disaster going on, this little mini disaster, this little mini disaster, and you have to try and deal with all of those, and you think, what is the point of doing all of this? So, Miller Appa said that it's no point, renounce the world. So he reaffirms his renunciation of even wood and single cloth garment up in the tree. But he's so weak from not having eaten that he faints. Anyway, eventually he comes round and he finds that he's very lonely. He's sitting there and he's thinking, oh, it'd be nice to be down in the valley, down with Marpa. You know, I could be receiving some teachings from Marpa, I could be hearing his inspiring words, getting new initiations, you know, learning new things, doing a bit of this, bit of that, and being with Marpa. I'd be with Dagmema, Marpa's wife, who was very kind to him. You know, she would be kind to me, she'd give me some nice food, and, you know, so he missed Dagmema. He missed the other disciples as well, his disciple brothers. You know, he says, we could compare notes, you know, we could see who's realised what, and kind of have, I suppose, kind of spiritual competitions about, you know, who's done the best realisation and so on. But he was missing all of this, and just feeling kind of pretty fed up with himself. That's the impression I get, pretty sort of down and fed up with himself. And then suddenly, on a cloud, a cloud appears in the distance, apparently, and starts moving towards him. And then sitting on this cloud, there is Marpa the translator, sitting, you know, on the cloud, actually come to see him. So this is quite a surprise. So what's happening here? Did Marpa really come? This is the question here. Was Marpa really there? Well, it seems as though Milarepa was thinking of him so intensely that this image appeared, either in meditation or as a vision. So, because of intense yearning, because of intense desire, the image comes into mind. Marpa, as it were, comes into Milarepa's presence. And Milarepa makes a connection with him through this image. And this imaginative connection is very, very important in the spiritual life. This kind of imaginative connection with something beyond us is important. Because in the spiritual life, we're having to connect with non-material forces, even with non-material personalities. I'm talking about things like metta, like contentment, like peace, like beauty, like tranquility, like equanimity, like compassion. These are spiritual forces that we're trying to make connection with. Now, in order to connect with them, we need some kind of image, some kind of image that can manifest those forces with which we can make a connection. This imaginative dimension to the spiritual life is quite crucial. Once he's made this connection with Marpa, then Milarepa is influenced very strongly by the presence of Marpa. He feels as though Marpa is actually there in his presence. And the appearance of Marpa encourages him. Marpa apparently says, look, you know what you're doing here. You know what you're doing in the mountain. You're being successful at it. Just get on with it. You know, you're committed to it. Just get on. Just follow through on your commitment. And because of this connection, because of this presence, this feeling of contact with Marpa, then that means that Milarepa gets inspired and he's able to return to his cave to get on with his practice. So the connection with Marpa has re-inspired him. This is the importance, in a way, of having a teacher or at least a spiritual friend who can somehow inspire you, you know, maybe through their own practice or because what they represent to you, so that when you bring them to mind, you have the facility of having them inspire you to your own practice. This is perhaps the value of a vertical spiritual friend. So, Milarepa goes back to his cave, ready to get on with the business of meditating. He goes into his cave, and what does he see in his cave but five demons? There's one demon sitting on his bed. There's one demon sort of pretending to meditate. There's another one flipping through his books. Well, I suppose like that, flipping through his books. And there's another two giving sort of Dharma talks to each other. So what does he do about this? So again, these symbols are another, they're an image. They're a symbol which may have arisen spontaneously. There's nothing to say that when Milarepa went back into his cave, he didn't actually see these five demons. I'm not saying that they were necessarily there materially. You know, you couldn't prod them or sort of measure their weight or anything like that. But he had this vision. He saw them there. They have risen spontaneously. They're an expression of a kind of mood. He doesn't really know who they are or what they are, what kind of demons they are. He has to figure out who they are. He has to try and give them a name to them. Because first of all, perhaps they're just a general mood, something a bit frightening or uncomfortable. They don't seem particularly terrible, these demons, but they're just kind of a bit irritating because they seem to be mocking him. They seem to be making fun of his spiritual practice. Now, in the life of Milarepa, we meet a host of non-human beings. They're appearing all the time. There's demons of various sorts. There's devas, more positive, brilliant, bit higher beings. And there's Dakinis. So what are we to make of all of these figures? We can't get away from them in Buddhism. They are there in the lives of the Buddha. The Buddha is often meeting with and communicating, not so much with demons, but certainly with Maras, and definitely with the Devas and Yakshas and so on. Padmasambhava's life, of course, is full of interactions with demons and Devas. And almost all Tibetan teachers that we hear about have had some kind of interaction with non-human beings of one form or another. And many Chinese and Japanese Buddhist teachers also have this contact with non-human beings. So non-human beings seem to be pretty pervasive throughout the whole of the Buddhist tradition. So it's not easy just to push them aside, say it's all, you know, it's Asian imagination, or it's sort of, you know, it's kind of primitive people's ways of looking at things. We can't really... This is the Buddha. In the Samyutta Nikaya, which is a great thick tome made up of several thousand suttas, which deal with the subject of meditation. Primarily that's what the Samyutta Nikaya seems to me to be about. Anyway, it's about meditation. It's made up of five books. The first of those books is entirely devoted to communication with devatas, with devas. So it's entirely devoted to the Buddha's interactions with devas. Now, why would that be there if there wasn't something very important to do with meditation? Devas have got something to do with meditation because they're in this big, thick book on meditation. So, I was trained as a physicist, a mathematician, physicist. And I was not at ease when I came along with Buddhism with the idea of non-human beings. If you couldn't measure it, as far as I'm concerned, it didn't exist. So I had a bit of a problem on my hand. And I asked Banti about it. I remember this, it was on retreat in 1972 up in Norfolk. And I said, no, it wasn't, it was in 1974. And I said, well, what about all these devas and things? What are we to do about them? And he said, as he quite often did, well, I've never had any trouble with them. I said, well, yeah, that doesn't help me, you know. So what he said, well, look, he said, just keep an open mind. Don't push them aside and don't pretend to sort of take them on in any kind of... superficial way, but just keep an open mind about what what they could be. Just do that. Well, I took that advice. And, at that retreat, I just moved to Cornwall. And I don't know how many of you know Cornwall or have been to Cornwall, but if Devas exist anywhere in this country, they live in Cornwall. There's something about the landscape, there's something about the place, the sea and the moors and the old buildings and so on. And when I was down there, I was living there by myself for some of the time, and I used to wander around by myself through the country. And every now and again, I used to come across a little spot, a little place, maybe a few trees or a little kind of valley inlet. And as I was there by myself, just sitting there, just not doing anything in particular, I could feel a presence. I could feel that something lived there. Yeah? And I thought, these are devas. This is what devas are. Devas are presences that we feel. Sometimes that presence is so strong that our minds give a form to it. They create a form. But sometimes it's not strong enough to do that. But we feel this kind of presence. Most of us know this experience. I like to say to people who say they don't believe in demons, well, I say, well, what happens when you walk through a really dark wood on a really dark night? Miles away from anywhere. You know, you're walking through this wood and there's a creek behind you. And all of a sudden you know there's a madman with an axe. Yeah? A mad demon with an axe running down the path about to give you the chop. Something like that. Or at least a ghost. You feel a presence. Something gives you the shivers. Okay, it's a projection of your fear. We all know that. We know the psychology, but the experiences, and in the Vajrayana, of course, we're interested in experience, the experience is that there is something dangerous there. Maybe not quite demonic, but at least pretty unpleasant. And then at other occasions, in other times, one can come across beings or non-human beings, as it were, that are far more evil, far more dangerous than that, but also far more delightful, far more beautiful than that as well. So non-human beings are very much part of the Buddhist world. There's a problem because in Western culture we've rejected the reality, and I've underlined here, the reality of myth, miracle and magic. Those things are real. They're not real on a material level, but they are real experiences. They're a real part of our experience. Artists are allowed entry into the world of the imagination. But it's not something that sensible, respectable, realistic people should bother themselves with. This is what we learn. But non-material forces and personalities do exist, and we ignore them at our peril. I'll just give you another example of something that really convinced me. This was in late 70s. I don't know if you know the Aiguille du Midi. In the French Alps, it's you can go up on a cable car from Chamonix, and it's about 13,000 feet, and you're on this pinnacle. It's actually even quite hard to breathe there, and you look out across the Mer de Glace, this big glacier. Mont Blanc is up here, 14,000 feet, a big dome of snow, and then across the Mer de Glace, you see mile after mile after 10 mile after 10 mile. Of mountain peaks, all standing up, all brilliant with white snow against a brilliant blue sky. And there you are, standing on this 14,000 foot pinnacle. You're about sort of that big. And the space is enormous. And the mountains are enormous. And you just feel like a shrimp. You feel so small. And I was convinced, I knew, that gods lived on those mountains. Powerful gods lived on those mountains and occasionally did things that were where they completely ignored the puny little human beings that were living down in the valleys. Do you know, there's a sort of sense of the awesome power of nature which one could see. And of course, those that's real. That is a real experience. So those gods are real. Images and the imagination evokes these presences, but they come not only necessarily through vision. When we tend to talk about images, we tend to think of visual images. But when we talk about images, I don't think we should limit ourselves to visual images. The imagination, of course, is not limited to the visual. We must remember that it also includes sound, includes all of the subtle senses, actually, sound, touch, perfume, maybe taste. I'm not so sure about taste. I don't know all that much about taste images. Maybe someone could tell me if they've had any later. But sound, of course, well, mantra is the obvious one, but music. Quite often one can hear music. You know, you hear it a lot at Kihiloka, and it's not rock bands, it's much better music than that. But you can hear sometimes in the evening, you can hear some lovely music or some quite mysterious music sometimes. Sometimes voices. You know, you can be meditating and suddenly a voice will sound quite clearly in your mind saying something quite distinct. And you don't know where it's come from. You don't know what it is. Mantra, of course, appears. I've had experiences of just sort of doing my mantra, or doing a mantra, it wasn't mine, doing a mantra, and then all of a sudden someone else comes in with the mantra, but so much more beautifully, so much more wonderfully, so much more delightfully. It was a Tara mantra, and just to sort of, that was Tara. Tara was chanting her mantra. You know, it was very clear to hear. It wasn't a human voice. It can be perfumes. Sometimes, again, for no apparent reason, a perfume can just waft through the shrine room. Sometimes more than one person can smell it, even though it's not a perfume with a material base, as it were. Bodily sensation is another area in which we can experience imaginative sensations. The brush against the skin, you know, sometimes it's just like a draft seems to maybe blow when there's no draft blowing. Or it can be rising of the hairs on the back of the neck. Or it can be a whole complex of experiences actually not only on the surface of body but within the body. I mean, this is the basis of all the bodily yoga. The yogas of Naropa, for example, take account of that kind of bodily imagination, sensation imagination. So it doesn't just have to be visual things. I will tell you one little story here. It's a bit shocking, but it's all right. I was down in Cornwall with a girlfriend. This was quite a long time ago. And, you know, well, when you're girlfriends, you do certain things that you just do with... Well, I just do with girlfriends. Anyway, we were doing that thing. And all of a sudden, we felt someone squeeze in between us.
Oh, my God.
It was such a strong experience that we just stopped what we were doing. I thought, I don't know what this is. Maybe it's a peeping Tom or something that sort of we've just kind of picked up. So I went outside, had a look around, couldn't see anybody. But it was a very definite, a very, very clear experience which we both felt. Now, this place where I lived at that time, it had a funny atmosphere. Before I lived there, I used to visit some friends who were there. And in going down there, I always used to feel kind of nervous, a bit uncomfortable. But when I lived there, I started to feel fine. In fact, very happy, very pleased to be there, very contented to be there. And other people had given a similar sort of description. When they came to the place, they were a stranger to the place, they always felt nervous. And I think my interpretation of this is that there was a young spirit, some kind of young ghost or spirit that lived there, who didn't like strangers, didn't like people coming in, but was quite happy with the people that it knew. So with the people that it knew, it was actually quite playful. So the place had this sort of playfulness. Anyway, I think it was trying to get reborn. That was my theory on this particular occasion. But fortunately, it did it in such a clumsy manner that it sort of... it blew the whole process, and I was saved the experience of having a little demon as a child. So anyway, sensation. You know, sometimes you can pick up these presences quite physically. The presence of non-material forces have to be felt, and we need to develop the sensitivity in able to be able to connect with them. Now, we normally live in the Karmaloka, the world of sense experience. The imagination does function in that realm, but not so obviously. But in the Rupa Loka, where our awareness moves away from normal senses to the subtle senses of the imagination, then these presences become we become more sensitive to them. We normally place much too much confidence on the realm of the senses as being the real world. Actually, the real world of the senses is no more and perhaps less real than the rupa and the arupa lokas, where we're experiencing our experience much more imaginatively. In the rupa loka, experience is given form by the imagination. And this form is necessary to complete the experience. I think this is quite an important factor. It's like one can have a sort of an experience in meditation, in dhyana, but you can't really grasp that experience unless it takes a form, unless it's got some kind of form. Now, Nanda's experience of the nymphs, I think, is a good example of this. The Buddha, we're told, took Nanda, I think it was to the heaven of the 33, and showed him the nymphs that were there. Now, looking at it a little more psychologically, I think what one could say is that the Buddha introduced, he somehow evoked within Nanda an experience of considerable refinement and beauty and delicacy. Mm. That this experience of beauty, a non-sense experience of beauty, it had to hook onto something. It had to create a name for itself in a way, or it had to create a form. Well, Nanda, we know, was obsessed by his beautiful lady that he'd left behind. So, of course, it's going to take a female form. And so that beauty takes female form in the form of the nymphs. But he can't actually experience the beauty until the form has been created. And I think this is quite crucial to meditation, actually. I think this happens a lot in meditation. It's like we can't actually get at our experience until a form to represent it arises simultaneously in the mind. So I think this is why in meditation it's very important to be very aware of what's going on all levels of experience. Not only visually, but orally, through smell, through sort of sensation in the body. Because those things are the things that give form to these higher experiences. So within the Rupa Loka, there is a hierarchy of increasingly beautiful, contentive and sublime forms, expressive of ever higher states of consciousness. Even the nymphs are relatively gross when compared to the higher angels. And even the formless, the so-called formless experiences of the Arupa Loka, the experience of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception, these in a way are just very subtle forms. Infinite space is a form. It's a very, very subtle form. It's getting right to the edge of form, but there is still a very subtle form there. And again, that form expresses the experience of infinite expansion of the self or infinite dissolution of the self. So this hierarchy extends from images of the most terrifying suffering in the hells to the most exalted and refined beauty of the highest heavens. But, of course, there is an even higher order of non-humans, and that's the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the highest Dakinis. These are manifestations of enlightenment itself, a different order from the things we've been talking about so far. So I have mentioned that these higher states of consciousness are not always experienced in personal forms. They can be experienced through the other senses, as we've said, but also, I think, through landscape. I think this is quite common, landscape. This is found in Milarepa's songs. Milarepa often describes the qualities of his experience through describing the landscape in which he lives. And as we heard the other day, sometimes other people saw it quite differently. They didn't always see the beauty in it that Milarepa saw in it. This is, I think, particularly true of Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, where there seems to be quite a stronger emphasis, in a way, on landscape as the form of higher spiritual experience. You only have to think of, you know, Chinese paintings and the paintings on pots and so on in China. You don't seem to get so much of that in India. I don't know much about Indian art, but I think Indian art tends to focus a lot more on human form as an expression of higher states, whereas Chinese and Japanese will use landscape. In this way, in this particular line of thinking, then enlightenment finds form in the various pure lands and Dakini lands that are described. Again, a different kind of landscape to even the most beautiful of a Japanese or Chinese landscapes. However, let's come down to earth a bit. Let's return to Milarepa and the demons. He's just had an inspiring connection with Marpa, who reminds him of his abilities and his commitments. But the demons mock him. They copy his practices and they make fun of him. Milarepa thinks they might be local deities that he's failed to please. We haven't got time to go into that, but he tries to appease them on that basis by reflecting on the beauty of the place. So Milarepa starts to, in a way, kind of express the beauty of the place in which he's living. But this doesn't do anything, the demons. The demons are completely unmoved by this. So Milarepa tries another tack. Well, actually, not only do they not get moved by his expressions of gratitude for the beauty of the landscape, they actually start to threaten him. So Milarepa decides that he'll drive them away by force. So he evokes wrathful deities. In other words, he evokes anger, he evokes sort of fear and terror, and tries to drive them away. But no effect on them whatsoever. They're not scared of that at all. So that doesn't work. He then tries preaching the Dharma to them with compassion. I imagine he's been able to develop some compassion for them. So he tries to teach them the Dharma. And normally what he does in this case, in this sort of situation, is he teaches the truth of karma vipaka. He teaches the sufferings of samsara. That's his normal way of dealing with recalcitrant demons at this level. But it didn't work. They weren't interested in that either. So in the end, Milarepa is left to the final device. He reminds himself that they are the product of his own mind and that he need have no fear. So he invites them to stay. He says, "You're welcome to stay and we can discuss the Dharma." And it says that he rushes at them. I suppose what this indicates is instead of holding back from them, he's moving towards them, sort of engaging with them. And what do they do? Poof, they just disappear. He gets rid of them. So he's recognised them. He's been able to actually identify the nature of the demons. What this is relevant to us, I think, is quite often demons appear in our life. We don't recognise them as such because we don't believe in demons. But they're still there. They might be in the form of, you know, an unfortunate person who lives down the road, or they might be in the form of an enemy to our country, or, you know, they could be all sorts of projections onto onto various peoples. And what we have to do is investigate the nature of that, of the qualities of those people on whom we projected things. If we can remove the projections, then the demon will vanish. We see that Milarepa has used some very familiar methods, actually. By praising the local environment, he's been trying to develop positive mental states. By evoking wrathful deities, he's been trying to restrain the demons. By teaching the Dharma, he's reflecting on the effect of karma and vipaka. And, of course, in the end, he's bringing higher insight to the experience. So these were the methods that Milarepa usually used against demons, one of those four different types of methods. Just to remind you, it's sort of praising them, praising their gifts, expressing gratitude to them, trying to scare them away. That doesn't usually work, though, actually. Teaching the Dharma, that sometimes works. That sort of manages to work sometimes. And bringing insight to the experience usually works in the end. Milarepa met some interesting demons and devas in his time, or demons in his time. On one occasion, whole armies arrived who shook mountains and even shook the sky in order to terrify him. There's one description of the whole horizon, 360 degrees, just glowing red, and then a demon army rising up above this stage. That's pretty scary. The next one's perhaps even more scary. A beautiful woman comes to see him, but she turns into a vicious red bitch and grabs his foot. Another day, he's just walking along down the valley, and he enters into this valley that is completely full of female sexual organs. And right in the middle, there's an enormous big one. So you're going to have to look that up to see how he dealt with that one. I'm not going to tell you. And one of my favourites is a demon king comes before him, stands before him in the form of a monkey riding on the back of a rabbit with a mushroom for a shield and a bow and arrow made of straw. He rides up to Milarepa and threatens him, tells him to quake with fear. And Milarepa can do nothing but just smile and laugh, and the demon just goes poof. So that's obviously how he... it's the same demon king, actually, that appeared, all around 360 degrees over the horizon. Same king. So obviously Milarepa managed to put him in his place, which is a monkey on the back of a rabbit. Okay, in the story... Another story now. In the story of Milarepa and the pigeons, we meet a much more supportive class of non-human being. Milarepa again is meditating in the mountains, and he's approached by a pigeon. And a pigeon walks around him a few times and nods and bobs, I suppose like pigeons do. And then flies off, and Milarepa follows the pigeon, and the pigeon takes him to a big pile of white rice and takes a few of the grains and brings and gives it to Milarepa. Gives a little offering of this white rice. So Milarepa is very pleased with this. And then seven more pigeons arrive, and they all start circumambulating and nodding and bowing. And Milarepa's, he's not fooled. He says, "I don't think you're pigeons. I think you're non-human beings of some sort. What are you?" And they reveal themselves as beautiful, beautiful devis, beautiful maiden devis, eight of them. And they've come, they're beautiful, they're smiling, and they ask Milarepa for the Dharma. So Milarepa sings them a song to them, teaches them the Dharma, And after that, this is what happens. With our heavenly eyes, we've been able to see you, and with respect and faith, we've now come to you for the Dharma. But in order to conceal our real form from sinful beings, we transformed ourselves into pigeons. We pray that your reverence will now be kind enough to come back to heaven with us to teach the Dharma. Can you see a reflection here of a story I told the other day? When Milarepa met the couple who had the farm, they offered for him to stay in the farm. Well, here you're getting the same sort of thing, but on a higher level. These eight devis are saying to Milarepa, will you come to heaven with us to teach the Dharma? But Milarepa replied, as long as life lasts, I shall remain in this world to benefit sentient beings here. You must know that heaven is far from dependable. It is not eternal, and one should not rely on it. To be born in heaven is not necessarily a wonderful thing. You should pay heed to the following instructions. And I'll read this song. I bow down at the feet of Marpa Lodrang, O Father Guru, pray grant me your grace wave and accomplishment. You eight beauties of the Deva realm had offered me white rice, the wondrous fruit of Dhyana. Eating it, my body strengthened and my mind enlivened. As a token of my gratitude, I sing this song of Dharma to you. Now, listen carefully. Even though one reaches the highest heaven of the white Devas, it has no permanent value and meaning. Lovable and touching are those flowers of youth in heaven. And how pleasant it may seem, but in the end it comes to separation. Although the bliss of heaven seems to be very great, it is merely a deceitful mirage, a bewildering hallucination. In fact, it is the very cause of the return to suffering. Thinking of the miseries of the six realms of samsara, I cannot help but have a feeling of disgust and aversion, a feeling of anguish and distressed emotion. Should you intend to practice the teaching of the Buddha, you must take refuge in the three precious ones and pray to him. I think this is quite interesting. He says, he's not telling them to. He's saying, should you intend to practice the teachings of the Buddha, you must take refuge in the three precious ones and pray to them. Sentient beings in the six realms you should consider as your parents. Give to the poor and offer to the Guru. For the benefit of all, dedicate your merits. Always remember that death may come at any moment. Identify your body with the Buddha's body. Identify your own voice with the Buddha's mantra. Contemplate the shunyata of self-awakening wisdom and always try to be master of your mind. So again, when even such beautiful beings come into his experience, such beautiful experiences arise, there's this always this recommendation to renounce it, to go beyond it, to continually take refuge in the three jewels. And in this case, he's also talking quite explicitly about developing love and compassion for all sentient beings. He also tells the maidens to be careful for the arising of negative mental states, because although they live in purely positive mental states, their realm, if you like, is made up of purely positive mental states, there's always a danger of negative mental states creeping in. There is another song here about that, but I don't have time to read it tonight. But it's a salutary reminder that even, you know, when you're thoroughly enjoying your meditation, when you're on retreat and everything's going really, really well, remember, negative emotions can just sort of creep in. So the advice is not to rest at higher levels of consciousness, but to continue to be mindful and to go for refuge to the three jewels and practice compassion. This is the advice that he gives to devas. This is always the advice he gives to them. He meets lots of beautiful devas which is quite encouraging. Now, so far, we've been looking at Milarepa's experiences whilst meditating in dhyana. But his main practice was Mahamudra, which is the highest level of practice stroke experience in the Vajrayana tradition. And it's a level of practice that goes beyond forms. So now we're going beyond the demons and the devas. The word mudra means a support. Means many things, but for this evening we call it a support. A mudra is a support. And maha means great. It's associated with shunyata. So Mahamudra is the ultimate support of one's practice. It's the enlightened vision itself. It's the realization of shunyata as the basis for one's practice. So Mahamudra is a continuous awareness of the nature of reality. It is therefore the point at which the path and our spiritual practice and the spiritual goal become identical. The experiences that we've spoken of so far, demons and devas and so on, they're all samsaric. They arise and they fall. They're born and they die. They come and they go. But Milarepa had gained insight into the nature of reality, which is beyond this impermanence, a different level of experience altogether. This reality had been pointed out by Marpa, and Milarepa's main practice was to maintain an awareness of that insight and to allow it to develop through its various stages. It's the same insight, but it's experienced ever more deeply. Now, Marpa was crucial to giving him that glimpse. The glimpse, the pointing out, is said to be gained through the grace and guidance of the guru. The grace of the guru means that the guru's realization is communicated with a resonance to something in the disciple. The disciple picks up something from the guru, some kind of resonance. And as a result of this, the disciple is convinced that the guru has revealed the truth. It could be through his words, it could be through his actions, it could be through ritual, it could be in, you know, a thousand different ways. But in some way, the guru has given the confidence of a particular view to the disciple. And the guidance of the guru, the other aspect of his function, is to provide instructions and support in maintaining and developing that glimpse. So the glimpse, in a way, is quite sort of magical. But the instructions and the guidance, they're very practical. They're very down to earth. Mahamudra is, in effect, the deepest level of the experience of mindfulness. We practice mindfulness of the breath. We practice mindfulness of the body. We practice mindfulness of mental states. We practice mindfulness of mental processes. But once we've had a glimpse of reality, and that becomes the object of our mindfulness, then our mindfulness rests on that. And this is the essence of Mahamudra. Now, meditation is progressive. Our experience and the way we practice will develop as we go along. One can no more jump into practicing Mahamudra than you could jump into playing a Bach sonata without ever having learnt the rudiments of playing a violin. Or you could solve differential equations of high order without ever learning any linear algebra. Or climb Mount Everest without doing some training on lesser peaks. In the case of a sonata, it would be a din. In the case of the differential equation, it would be a joke. And in the case of climbing Everest, it would probably be your death. So one doesn't practice Mahamudra without establishing some good groundwork, unless you want to create an absolute din in your life. You want to look a complete idiot, or you want to die. Those are the warnings. We're not told much about Milarepa's training in meditation, but we can see something of this process in his teaching to a young shepherd. Can I have 10 more minutes?
Yeah.
And this comes through the song, The Shepherd's Search for Mind. So I'm going to finish just by going fairly briefly through this song. One day, two shepherds came to Milarepa. The younger one asked, "Dear Lama, do you have a companion?" Milarepa, by the way, is up in the mountains meditating in a cave. Milarepa replied, "Yes, I have." "Who is he?" "His name is Friend Bodhihart, Bodhicitta." "Where is he now?" "In the house of the universal seed consciousness." "What do you mean by that?" "My own body." That was the conversation that went on between the young shepherd and Milarepa. The elder boy then said, "Lama, we had better go, as you cannot guide us." But the younger one said, "Do you mean this consciousness is mind itself, and that the physical body is the house of the mind?" Milarepa replies, "Yes, that is correct." The boy continued, "We know that although a house usually belongs only to one person, many people can enter it. So we always find a number of people living in one house. In the same way, is there only one mind in the body, or are there many? If there are many, how do they live together?" "Well, as to whether there's only one mind in the body or many, you had better find that out by yourself." So this is the connection. This is the connection between Milarepa, and it's obviously very bright, very well-prepared, in a way, karmically well-prepared young shepherd. At this point, the boys leave and return home. The young boy comes back and has told gives Milarepa the results of his thoughts, and Milarepa's sufficiently impressed with those to sing a song to him. He says, "Listen to me, dear shepherd, the protector of sheep. By merely hearing about sugar's taste, sweetness cannot be experienced. Though one's mind may understand what sweetness is, it cannot experience directly. Only the tongue can know it. In the same way, one cannot see in full the nature of mind, though he may have a glimpse of it if it's been pointed out by others. If one relies not on this one glimpse, but continues searching for the nature of mind, he will see it fully in the end. Dear shepherd, in this way you should observe your mind." So he's offering. He's making an offer the shepherd can't really refuse. And he does. He takes it up. The shepherd receives a few more instructions from Milarepa. He goes away. He reflects about mind in certain ways. Then he comes back and gives his answer to Milarepa. Milarepa gives him some more instruction. The young man goes away, comes back again, and so on. And part of one of the other songs, Milarepa says, "Listen carefully, dear shepherd. Clinging to the notion of ego is characteristic of this consciousness. If one looks into this consciousness itself, one sees no ego. Of it, nothing can be seen. If one can practice the teaching of Mahamudra and knows how to see nothing, something will be seen. To practice the teaching of Mahamudra, one needs great faith, humility, and zeal as the foundation. One should understand the truth of karma and causation as the path. In order to achieve the accomplishment, one should depend upon a guru for the initiation, instruction, and inner teaching. It requires a disciple possessing merit to receive the teaching. It requires a man who disregards discomfort and suffering. It requires the courage of fearlessness, the defiance of death. Dear shepherd, can you do these things? If so, you are well destined. If not, it's better not to talk about the subject. This ask yourself and think carefully." Well, the young man does think, not particularly carefully actually, but he thinks, and he says, "Yes, I do want to do this." So Milarepa gives him the three refuges and then teaches him to visualize the Buddha Shakyamuni above his head. The young man goes off to try this visualization, and a week, 10 days go by, and there's a bit of a panic in the village because the young boy's disappeared. Nobody knows where he is. They come to Milarepa to try and find him, and Milarepa says, "No, I haven't seen him. He was here a week ago, but I haven't seen him since then." And eventually they find him in a quarry, and they give him a little shake, and they say, well, where have you been all week? And he says, oh, I've just been sitting here for a few minutes meditating on this Buddha. And they said, no, you've been here for 7 days. Oof. And he says, no, that can't be so. But he notices the sun's in a different place. And so he realises that, in fact, he's been there for a long time. He's obviously capable of concentration, this young lad. But after that experience, apparently he becomes very disoriented. He's not very good with time. He's always wandering off. He gets late. He's sort of becoming completely unreliable as a shepherd. And he's becoming a real problem to his family and everybody in the village. But they're decent folk. And what they say with him, okay, we'll give you some food. You can go off and live with Milarepa. And of course he loves that. So he's off and he goes to live with Milarepa. Milarepa then teaches him the five precepts. Yeah. So those of you, you know, those people that think that Mahamudra doesn't involve the precepts, completely wrong. You know, Milarepa, here he is, teaching a prime Mahamudra disciple the five precepts. Also teaches him the doctrine, teaches him various doctrinal formulations, and the teaching of the innate born wisdom. We're not told how long this takes, but you get the impression that it's probably a period of years. The boy then, you know, goes off into the mountains and meditates. At one point he comes back to see Milarepa, and Milarepa gives him a little bit of advice. I'm going to read this song in full, and then we'll be finished. Milarepa sings, I bow down at the feet of Marpa, he who received grace from Naropa and Madripa. Those who practice the Dharma with their mouths talk much and seem to know much teaching. But when the time comes for the perceiver to leave the deadened body, the mouth-bound preacher into space is thrown. Now, this is one of Milarepa's major themes. We got it being given to Rechumpa. He gives it to all of his yogi disciples. Be careful you don't take the teaching literally. Be careful you don't just get stuck with a rational, scholastic understanding of the teaching. Always back up your understanding of the Dharma with practice. When the clear light shines, the clear light of a reality, it is cloaked by blindness. The chance to see the Dharmakaya at the time of death is lost through fear and confusion. Sorry, that's what happens to those, to the mouth-bound preachers. Even though one spends his life in studying the canon, it cannot help at the moment of the mind's departure. But then Milarepa also looks at the thing from another point of view. He says, alas, those proficient yogis who long have practiced meditation mistake the psychic experience of illumination for transcendental wisdom and are happy with this form of self-deception. Therefore, when at death the transcendental wisdom of the Dharmakaya shines, these yogis cannot unify the light of mother and son. Since meditation cannot help them as they die, they are still in danger of rebirth into the lower realms. This is the other warning to yogis, the warning not to get caught up on higher states of consciousness and think that those are the goal of the spiritual life. Yeah, but we'll see what he says about it. My dear son, the best of laymen, listen to me carefully. When your body is rightly posed and your mind absorbed deep in meditation, you may feel that thought and mind both disappear. Non-dual state. Yet this is but the surface experience of dhyana. By constant practice and mindfulness thereon, one feels reliant, radiant self-awareness shining like a brilliant lamp. It is pure and bright as a flower. It is like the feeling of staring into the vast, empty sky. The awareness of voidness is limpid and transparent, yet vivid. This non-thought, this radiant and transparent experience is but the feeling of dhyana. With this good foundation, one should further pray to the three precious ones and penetrate to reality by deep thinking and contemplation. He thus can tie the non-ego wisdom with the beneficial life rope of deep dhyana. In other words, you need both. You need to penetrate by understanding into the Dharma, and you need the dhyana, the experience of tranquility, to support it. Those two things have to be done in a balanced way, like the two wings of the bird. Overemphasize the study, the bird can't fly. Overemphasize the meditation, the bird will also one day fall to the ground. And it brings in another factor here. With the power of kindness and compassion, and with the altruistic vow of the Bodhi heart, he can see direct and clear the truth of the enlightened path, of which nothing can be seen, yet all is clearly visioned. He sees how wrong were the fears and hopes of his own mind. Without arrival, he reaches the place of the Buddha. Without seeing, he visions the Dharmakaya. Without effort, he does all things naturally. Dear son, the virtue seeker, bear this instruction in your mind. So that was Milarepa's, in a way, his last teaching to Rinpoche Sangye Jap, one of his main disciples. So we've seen very different types of meditation experience, dealing with demons on the one hand, dealing with the negative forces that come up in meditation, dealing with the positive forces that come up in meditation, and here, going beyond those distinctions altogether. So in this little mini-series, we've looked at Milarepa's life. We've explored that. We've reflected on his joyful practice of renunciation. We've had a glimpse into his relationship with one of his main disciples. And today we've touched on Milarepa's experiences of meditation. Milarepa's life is very, very rich. I mean, this is just one half of the thousand songs. This is an original version, by the way. It's a very, very rich story. There's an enormous amount that you can get from reading it. So I hope that we, you know, as a result of this week, those of you who have not known Milarepa before will continue to develop his friendship. And those that have, perhaps, will be re-inspired to develop it even more.